end, you have a sense of futility. Like, you've spent, you know, months of your life reliving one of the worst nights of your life.
A Juno woman calls on Stanford University to do a better job punishing students who commit a sexual assault. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, seeing the world from a polar bear's point of view.
We can start to get a much more in-depth understanding of how bears are using these different habitats.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
The U.S. Senate is poised to pass a spending bill that includes more than $150 million for federal programs important to Alaska's fishing industry and marine navigation. It includes $4 million for electronic monitors for the fishing fleet. Alaska fishermen on small boats have asked for cameras as a substitute for some of the human observers that record catch data. Senator Lisa Murkowski told her colleagues electronic monitors will allow the mission to continue.
But recognizing that our small fishermen just simply cannot put another body on their boat as they're out working.
The bill also includes $25 million for sonar mapping of coastlines with an emphasis on the need for more data on the Bering Straits and the Arctic. It has $6 million for removing marine debris, especially debris from Japan's 2011 tsunami that washed up on federal land. The bill funding commerce, justice, and science programs passed the Senate Appropriations Committee this week. Former Juneau Representative Beth Kurtula has joined the Obama administration as director of the National Ocean Council Office. Since January, Kurtula has been a visiting fellow at Stanford University's Center for Ocean Solutions. She was appointed to the federal job on Wednesday and is already at work in Washington, D.C. The job was announced in an email to her Stanford colleagues, where Kurtula has been working on ocean issues. She has described her role there as a conduit between state legislatures and science policymakers, bringing them together to discuss ocean policies. President Obama established the council by executive order in 2010. Now Kurtula will lead the office that supports it. The Alaska Energy Authority held public meetings in the Upper Valley and Anchorage this week to discuss the plans for the proposed Susitna-Wautana hydroelectric project. In addition to AEA's updates on the progress and plans for the mega project, opponents to the dam expressed concerns. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
Both the Talkeetna and Anchorage meetings began with a presentation by Wayne Dyock, project manager for Susitna-Wautana. He says that the Susitna Dam remains a key part of the state's goal for 50% of Alaska's energy to come from renewable resources by 2025. Wayne Dyock says that while AEA is interested in wind and other alternative energy projects, that the large dam would provide stability to the overall grid.
But without having some kind of resource like a hydro, it's difficult to put that into the system and still have a stable electric system. We also want, reliable, energy and sustainable, energy and energy that's, clean.
Wayne Dyock says that the Susitna-Wautana project would also have a significant impact on greenhouse gas emissions.
Susitna-Wautana would displace around 1.3 million tons of CO2, annually. That's actually a pretty significant number. And that's equal to about the emissions from half the cars that are registered in the state of Alaska.
AEA refers to Susitna-Wautana as, quote, clean, reliable energy for the next 100 years on nearly all of its distributed materials. It also claims that the long-term price of energy would stabilize, then drop with Susitna-Wautana. AEA's estimates show the cost of natural gas generation catching up to the price of power from the dam about 12 years after completion in 2036. It says the price of power from Susitna would then drop sharply in 2052 after the project would ostensibly be paid off. Those cost estimates have met with some challenge, however. In 2012, Dr. Steve Colt of the Institute of Economic Research at the University of Alaska in Anchorage said that the initial cost of power when the dam comes online will be significantly higher than what AEA estimates. That study was brought up at the Talkeetna meeting. Wayne Dyock says that the different results are a product of different assumptions regarding financing of the project.
We looked at some of the assumptions that he did, and we gave him our information. So he actually has what we put. And the model should give you the same thing. If you put the same inputs, the output should be the same.
Many of the comments from the crowd of 80-plus in the Upper Susitna Valley centered around environmental concerns. Fish habitat, seismic activity, caribou migration, and other topics that have consistently been brought up as concerns were reiterated by residents of the communities that would be downstream from the project if it is built. Many of those questions were answered by the members of the project team that were also in attendance. A few members of the audience also challenged the reliability of the material that AEA is sending to the general public. One of those is Molly Wood, a member of the Chase Community Council. She specifically referenced a graphic that shows fish passage up to and beyond the proposed dam site. She says that the way the information is presented is incomplete and misleading.
That really makes it look like there aren't any fish in this river, and you know you've had much feedback already, and that continues to show up at all of these meetings and is being sent out in pamphlet form all over Alaska, and it misrepresents the results of your studies, number one. And you're drawing very premature conclusions about the potential impact.
At a similar meeting on Wednesday in Anchorage, AEA faced many of the same environmental questions as in Talkeetna from an audience of about 50. Nobody in the audience rose to speak in favor of the project at either meeting. AEA plans to conduct studies this summer despite budget cuts, and fieldwork is scheduled to continue through 2015. If all goes to plan, construction would begin on the project around 2019. That's all contingent on receiving the $90 million in funds that AEA says are necessary to complete the pre-licensing process. With legislative attention shifting to a gas pipeline, and with the project receiving less than half of the total funds requested by Governor Sean Parnell this year, however, that's far from a certainty. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a look at the obedience required to be an Anchorage police dog.
So I'll give him the command to bark, and then I'll give him the command to go down and be quiet, which is still.
Give up. Still.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Until this week, Leah Francis was probably best known as an Alaska distance running champ from her days at Juno Douglas High School. That all changed after she went public, saying she was forcibly raped by a fellow Stanford University undergraduate. KTOO's Jeremy Shea reports.
Leah Francis came out as a rape survivor and as an activist outraged over Stanford University's in-house adjudication process.
No one wants to do the alternate review process. It's super traumatizing. I mean, it's dragged out. It's mishandled.
The university panel formally concluded the male student did sexually assault Francis. The decision was based on a university investigation and statements from both sides, according to university documents via the Stanford Daily. The university has kept the male student's name confidential, and Francis declined to name him. She wants to keep the focus on the bigger issues, like the university's consequence for rape. The panel recommended 40 hours of community service, a sexual assault awareness education class, and a 5-quarter suspension. That suspension wouldn't take effect until the summer, which Francis says is after her assailant graduates. It's a slap on the wrist, she says, that invites my rapist back to campus for grad school.
In the end, you have a sense of futility, like you've spent, you know, months of your life reliving one of the worst nights of your life, and you don't get anything out of it.
She emailed out her story on Tuesday and has been riding the wave of support since. Thursday night, she said,
I haven't eaten today and I haven't slept in 48 hours.
Earlier, Francis led hundreds of students in a campus rally and protest to raise awareness about sexual assault and to demand reforms. They want mandatory expulsion for sexual assault as well as better resources for victims. Students yelled in unison for administrators to stand with Leah. They plastered campus surfaces with posters and signs incorporating the Stand With Leah hashtag and blew it up on Twitter.
This was awesome. I mean, today was more healing for me than anything that's happened since I was raped.
And she's gotten a lot of media attention.
So I communicated with BuzzFeed, with Huffington Post, with the New York Times. I just can't even keep track of them all. LA Times, Palo Alto Weekly, Stanford Daily.
Francis says a criminal case is also open with the Juneau Police Department. The incident happened in Juneau early on New Year's Day. She says she was in no condition to consent when it began, drunk and unconscious. Police could not be reached for comment by deadline. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
It's been just over a week since Alaska State Troopers called off the search for missing Juneau hiker Sharon Bice. But a group of volunteers have taken on the effort and are still looking, KTOO's Lisa Fu reports.
Luke Holton doesn't know 48-year-old Sharon Bice, but he's helping to organize the volunteer search that started Wednesday.
I'm an outdoorsman myself, and I understand if I was out here in the cold, and I wouldn't want anyone to give up on me.
Holton and other volunteers have set up a search table at the bottom of the Mount Roberts tramway and meet there each morning. On Wednesday, three teams of three searched Granite Creek Basin and Perseverance Trail, getting off the trail as much as possible when safe to do so. Holton was on top of Mount Roberts Thursday afternoon, along with six other volunteers. They hiked to Icy Gulch and are sending skiers there by helicopter Friday. These areas were covered extensively during the five-day search led by the Alaska State Troopers, but Holton says there's no reason to give up hope of finding some sort of clue.
It's unlikely that we'll find anything too positive at this point, but for the family's sake, you know, we want to keep looking no matter what we find.
Holton met with Bice's brother and sister-in-law who came to Juneau from Ontario, Canada. He says they left Thursday but asked to be kept updated on the search. One of Bice's hiking friends said Bice owned a yellow backpack. It's an unofficial lead, Holton says, but it's something to look for. He hopes the volunteers can find anything that will restart the official search.
The best option we would have is to find some of her personal property up here or anything else. The further we go in, the less tracks you're going to find in the snow. So once we get past Icy Gulch and you find tracks in the gulch or tracks on the peak of Gastineau, then that could potentially also be enough evidence.
Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says a decision to start searching again will be based on what's found.
It's going to be evaluated based on what is located and if we can confirm it belonged to Ms. Bice or not. Certainly, if they find something and it is identified as one of her possessions, it gives us a new place to look.
Bice is in the Alaska State Troopers Missing Persons Clearinghouse, a database for law enforcement only. Peter says any missing person in Alaska is entered into the database and stays there until they are found dead or alive. She says a volunteer search group could help close a missing persons case.
Troopers can't always be everywhere. There's a lot of things that we have to go and put our attention to and our resources towards. Certainly, with search and rescue cases, we want them to have a positive resolution. And finding somebody, even if they're deceased at that point, at least we can provide some type of closure. We can return them to their families.
When troopers called off the search and rescue effort, Juneau Police Department took over the case. Spokeswoman Erin Kalwara says detectives started working on it this week.
The detective has started reaching out to the missing person's friends and her family, just discussing things that have been going on in her life, talking about where they think she might be, if they have any ideas of any lead that he could investigate, just trying to ensure that if she was hiking and she went missing, that that's truly what happened.
She says they have no reason to believe anything suspicious took place, although they haven't ruled anything out. Kalwar also says there's no information to link Bice's case with Sandra Gelber, the 61-year-old woman who died May 4th after being found in the water off Salmon Creek Trail. Both women were physical therapists, and both cases are linked to hiking trails. Bice has been missing since May 24th. When she didn't show up for a planned group hike with the Juneau Alpine Club that morning, a friend reported her missing. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
The Chitna Sub-District Dipnet Salmon Fishery opens at midnight. KCHU's Tony Gorman reports.
A late spring breakup and heavy flooding last year pushed the opening of the Chitna Sub-District Dipnet Fishery back a couple of weeks. But that's not the case this year.
Well, yeah, the fish are moving up the river a lot more quickly this year. The breakup was early, and it looks like the run is running about 5 to 7 days early.
In an interview on KCHU's Coffee Break this morning, Alaska Department of Fish and Game Upper Copper Upper Susitna Area Management Biologist Mark Somerville said the Copper River's low water conditions from the early breakup is a huge factor in the fish coming so early. Travel time from the sonar near the Million Dollar Bridge in Cordova to Chitna is usually 2 weeks. This year's estimated average is 7 to 10 days. Somerville said the fast start won't affect the catch limit.
15 for an individual or household of one, or 30 fish for a household of two or more. But we're also at the process here. We have a what's called supplemental periods, which go into effect if the actual sonar counts are 50,000 or more fish greater than what we projected for the cumulative for that particular week.
Somerville said there will be a supplemental period during the first opening. During that time, dip netters have a great opportunity to catch kings. Somerville said Copper River kings are being closely monitored, and Fish and Game could take emergency action if needed within the coming weeks.
The king salmon stocks right now, the original forecast for the year, the preseason forecast was for 62,000 king salmon to return to the Copper River. At this time, the indicators from the commercial fishery and from sampling wheels that are in the Copper River that do a mark recapture study there run by the Native Village of EAC. Both those indicators right now are showing that the run is substantially weaker than originally thought.
The catch limit for kings in the fishery is one per household. The first opening of the Chitna Subdistrict Dip Net Fishery is at midnight and ends at 11:59 p.m. on Sunday. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey are using new video collars to get a glimpse into the daily life of polar bears. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Researchers have been using radio and GPS collars since the 1980s to track polar bears' movements along the Arctic sea ice. But that data lacks a lot of contextual and observational information that allows for a better understanding of the bears. Anthony Pagano is a research biologist with USGS. He says these new collars were deployed in April on 4 female bears along the sea ice north of Prudhoe Bay.
We can start to get a much more in-depth understanding of how bears are using these different habitats, potentially how often they're eating, and get an understanding of how much time they spend walking, how much time they spend swimming, how much time they spend resting. Which is information we really don't have that much knowledge about right now.
Pagano hopes the new information will allow researchers to gain a better understanding of how polar bear behaviors might change with different sea ice conditions and other environmental patterns. The cameras were on the bears for a little over a week and gathered between 30 and 40 hours of footage each, which scientists are still sorting through. Clips released by the USGS show bears swimming under the sea ice, eating a seal, and interacting with potential mates. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
To see video from the polar bear's point of view, go to alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ed Schoenfeld. This week on AK, police dogs. Dog owners know the challenges of training, the difficulties in getting their pet to stop jumping up on people or even barking. Police dogs have to excel at those basic tasks and then go beyond to meet a remarkable level of obedience. KNBA's Jocelyn Estes recently met up with Anchorage police dog Airy and his handler in an Anchorage parking lot. She has this story.
Aries, sitting on the asphalt, alert and focused on his handler and on the thick rubber stick Anchorage police officer Lonnie Brown is holding with both hands.
So I'll give him the command to see he's looking at the toy right now. Still. And I'll give him the command that he can have it, which is a free command. Free. So he's biting the toy right now.
Aries tries to rip it out of Brown's hands.
So I'll give him a release command. Los.
Brown tosses the toy a couple dozen feet away and frees Airy to go after it. Then he gives the stop command, and Airy stops in his tracks. Then, on command, Airy walks backwards away from the toy.
Kasadik.
Brown has been a handler in the Anchorage Police Department's canine unit for almost 15 years. His 2.5-year-old canine partner, Airy, is brown and black. You can see a few of Airy's ribs, which Brown says is a sign the dog is at just the right weight for a Belgian Malinois.
Belgian Malinois are considered, they kind of look like a shepherd, but they're real skinny. But they have the play drive and the activity drive of a Dalmatian. So they're really an active dog.
Along with that high drive, Brown says, police dogs have to have the right personality or character, a strong hunting and chasing instinct and loyalty. They need to be obedient to a fault, but also independent enough to work alone and to make certain decisions.
If you became aggressive and you shoved me right now, he'd automatically bite you because that's a trained behavior because you're aggressive towards the handler or aggressive towards another police officer.
Brown says Airy is trained to track people through scents on the ground. The dog has tracked down many suspects. His latest, for example, was a nighttime operation, finding a burglar who had fled and hidden behind a wooden box. In his year and a half in service, Airy has captured two suspects, including a man who took a shot at a police officer. Brown says when Airy is sent to catch a fleeing suspect, he's trained to take a flying leap to get the suspect on the ground.
If a dog is apprehends somebody when they're running away and hits them high center of mass in between the shoulder blades, it will force the suspect to the ground. Because, you know, you have a 70-pound dog going certain miles per hour, launching through the air, it will topple somebody over.
Once the dog launches, it's trained to bite the suspect. It sometimes gets an arm or leg, but it's trained to bite in the upper back.
Because there's not a big muscle group there, it's not a lot of injury is inflicted by that. They can't really get a hold of any bones and break them.
But if the suspect stands still or is passive, Airy is trained to hold them in place and bark. He's also trained to bark when he finds a suspect and to not bark on command.
Say you have him barking at a door and you gave commands for the guy to give up and you want to see if the guy's going to answer you back. You don't want this dog to continue to bark, so you want him to be down and quiet. So I'll give him the command to bark, and then I'll give him the command to go down and be quiet, which is still. Give him up. Still. Give him up.
Airy pulled the windsock off my microphone. He thinks it's a toy. And it's time for his toy. Brown gives the rubber stick to him, and Airy looks pretty pleased as he chews on it. Judging by its tattered look, he's made some progress in tearing the tough toy to pieces, which is not surprising since the Belgian Malinois can exert hundreds of pounds of force through its jaws, another characteristic of the breed that makes it a favorite for police work. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Now, it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're headed to Togiak on Bristol Bay.
Yeah, this is Daryl Thompson. I'm the city administrator for the city of Togiak in Bristol Bay. I've been here for 34 years, and it has almost doubled in population. And in size, we're expanding. And there's about 890 people here presently. We've got a very active fishing fleet. Of course, a big store. And we've got the Bristol Bay Housing Authority has helped build a lot of additional housing, which we were very in need of, and we're continuing to build more houses. And we've got a fish processing plant right in the community that's paying probably the best price in Bristol Bay for salmon. Well, mainly the main fish for the village, of course, is sockeye. We do have king salmon for halibut fishing, and we just finished a big herring run, which is an annual spring event here also. People are very interested in the subsistence lifestyle. Right now, ladies are out looking for fiddlehead ferns and also looking for seagull eggs or different bird eggs. We have Walrus Island, which is a tourist location about 40 miles away out to the ocean. We have a moose population. We have a large bear population. And, of course, right now the spring ducks and spring geese have just came through. This last weekend we all went clam digging down at Kalukuk Bay, so the whole village was down there gathering clams on the minus tide. And then if you don't go down river, down the bay, you can go up river and catch trout or later on salmon.
Daryl Thompson is city administrator for the city of Togiak. 300 Villages is a case attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Jocelyn Estes, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Rosemary Alexander, Lisa Fu, and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, and Tony Gorman in Valdez. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce. From healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants, Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.